Thank you very much. So this panel is going to be a discussion with three experts, and we're going to all address the question of university research collaboration with the for-profit sector, and we're going to try to address exactly some of the issues that were raised in the last panel by Professor Ellis, mainly to do with the tensions created when university research is funded by corporate or industry sectors. So I'm just going to introduce right now all three of the panelists, and they're all going to, each of them will speak for about 10 minutes, and then that should leave us adequate time for question answer, as well as maybe some interchange between them. So the first speaker will be Chris McDonald, sitting right here. He's the Associate Professor and Director of the Jim Pattison Ethical Leadership Research and Education Program at Ryerson University's Ted Rogers School of Management. Second, we will have Daniel Weinstock. In 2012, so very recently, Daniel became a professor in the Faculty of Law at McGill University. And this August, actually, he was appointed the director of McGill's Institute for Health and Social Policy. Before that, for almost a decade, he was the founding director of the Centre de Recherche en Éthique de l'Université de Montréal. And then finally, we have our own My Political Science colleague, Phil Oxhorn. He's a professor of political science at McGill, as well as the founding director of McGill's Institute for the Study of International Development. And he's also the editor of, in chief of the international journal Latin American Research Review. Okay, so I'll just give each of them 10 minutes, and then we'll take questions and try to start an exchange between them. So, Chris?
Thanks very much, Catherine. I'm going to do kind of you know what perhaps I should have done earlier in the day. Now that I think about it, is because I'm as a philosopher by training, my tendency is to want to sort of lay out the groundwork and provide some conceptual tools. So I'm going to talk a bit about ethics, kind of generally, a little bit about its role in institutions, and ultimately talk a bit about conflict of interest and risk assessment. Rather than speaking directly, exclusively about the role of industry in funding research, give you some tools to wrap around that notion, that set of issues. So ethics is basically the structured critical examination of standards of human behavior, or the behavior of people in institutions. So it's fundamentally about what we should do, it's about the principles we should adopt and who we want to be. Now there are a couple of really difficult and pernicious myths about the topic of ethics. One is that it's all just a matter of opinion, right? Because you and I may have different opinions on lots of things. It's a mistake, though, to think that we can leave it at that, because there are better and worse reasons. And good ethics isn't just about having an opinion; it's about giving reasons. It's about providing an argument, and there are gooder and worser arguments, just like there is gooder grammar. The second myth is that ethics is the study of how to behave like an angel. Right? This is the second myth that generates a fair bit of cynicism. If you think of ethics as being about what's the absolute highest pinnacle of perfection, of great behavior, think of whoever you can think of as a moral hero. If it's about acting like that unachievable pinnacle of ethical behavior, then it can seem like ethics is kind of an esoteric, rarefied, maybe even irrelevant topic, and we shouldn't think of ethics that way. We should think about ethics as the study of what are the reasonable constraints on our behavior, what are reasonable rules to adopt as we go about life and go about business. The second thing I want to talk about is the role of ethics at institutions. I teach ethics. I teach ethics at a business school. Now, you only have to teach ethics in business for about a day before you start hearing the obvious and frankly kind of dumb joke about business ethics being an oxymoron or a contradiction in terms, right? So someone will say, business ethics, isn't that an oxymoron? Or organizational ethics or ethics in institutions. About a day is about all it takes to reach that joke, and about a week is where you reach your threshold for that joke. The truth, of course, and the reason it's a dumb joke, I mean, it's an attractive kind of joke. It's easy, shooting fish in a barrel. But the truth is that ethics is fundamental to the work of organizations of all kind, whether it's a private corporation, whether it's a university faculty, whether it's a government department. Ethics is fundamental to the functioning of organizations of all kinds. Because without trust, teams of people cannot work together and they cannot carry out their mission. Okay? So you need basic patterns of honesty, of promise-keeping, and of fairness. That's the only way you build up the levels of trust that allow organizations, private or public, to function. So you need some kind of ethics for organizations to exist at all. Okay? Of course, organizations can behave badly, and individuals within organizations can behave badly over substantial periods of time, but you need something, right? You need something like a set of rules, a set of standards for behavior in order for the thing to function. So the notion of ethics can't be antithetical to organizational life. It's closer to the opposite, right? It's nearly a redundancy to say that ethics is an essential part of organizations. The result is, right, that this helps us frame ethics, the role of ethics in institutions, this way. Ethics isn't an external set of rules imposed on organizations or imposed on people who work in organizations. It's an enabling mechanism, right? So ethics is about finding out, right, whether it's within a faculty of medicine or within a private corporation, figuring out which rules are going to help us get the mission done appropriately. The third thing I want to talk about is conflict of interest, because it's one of the sort of ethical issues that can most readily frustrate organizational missions. So a conflict of interest, we kick this term around a lot. Not very many people can actually tell you what a conflict of interest is. Even most people who've read conflict of interest policy mostly can't, because most policies don't do a very good job of defining it, frankly. And I know that specifically from a study we did a few years ago of university conflict of interest policies, and found they were all generally pretty miserable. A conflict of interest is just a situation in which a person has a private or personal interest sufficient to appear to influence the objective exercise of his or her official duties as, say, a public official, an employee, or a professional. Now, on the surface, this implies that conflict of interest is about jeopardizing judgment. Not necessarily corrupting judgment, but jeopardizing judgment. But the more important truth about conflict of interest is that it's a problem for institutions because it jeopardizes faith in the institution. Right? So think about what would happen if a judge were to sit in judgment of a case where a close family member was the defendant. Right? This would not just bring into disrepute that judgment, it would bring the courts into disrepute. It would lessen our faith in the justice system. Similarly, imagine a civil servant being on a hiring committee when a close relative or a spouse, an offspring, is one of the job candidates. Right? It's not just that we doubt the fairness of that decision. We might have absolute confidence in the judgment and abilities of that individual, but the public is still going to wonder, and we're still going to lessen people's confidence in the civil service. And that's why conflict of interest is a problem. Conflict of interest, the standard advice is to do things like avoid it when you can, but you can't always. To disclose conflict of interest when you can't avoid it. Problem is that disclosure isn't always effective because the people you disclose to don't always know what to do with that information. If your doctor says, oh, by the way, I'm paid by a drug company, do you go get a new doctor? Do you discount their advice? How much do you discount their advice? A little bit, a lot. Sometimes you just have to cope with conflict of interest and do the best you can. The key to remember about conflict of interest is that conflict of interest is not an accusation. It's a situation. You can be in a conflict of interest through no fault of your own. So to say someone's in a conflict of interest is simply to point out the nature of the relevant motivation, the motivational structure of the situation. I want to talk briefly, transition from talking about conflict of interest to talking about risk assessment. And I'm going to use as a parallel, not asbestos, but something I know only marginally more about, which was a case that had to do with the approval of chemical herbicides back in the 80s. So there's a great book back in the 90s, a great book in the nerdy academic sense. It was extremely dull, but really useful book, written by friends of mine. Brunk, Haworth, and Lee wrote this great book called Value Assumptions and Risk Assessment, and it was about the controversy over the chemical herbicide Alachlor back in the mid-80s. So Alachlor was a chemical herbicide approved for use in the U.S. and not approved here in Canada. There were worries that it was carcinogenic. The company that produces Alachlor, Monsanto, objected. Health Canada decided to convene an independent panel. And the gist of it was, to cut a long story short, everyone did their science, right? Monsanto's scientists did their science. Health Canada did its science. the review panel did its science, they all used the same studies, in fact. They all used the same numbers. They all did the math. And what came out in the wash was that Health Canada said that Alicor was not just twice as carcinogenic, not just 10 times, 1 million times as carcinogenic as Monsanto said it was. And they're all doing science the same way. They're all using the same tools. The difference was in the value assumptions they made. Okay? So Monsanto said, how do we measure how much Alicor is going to get into a farmer's system when he's using this stuff? And they said, well, first, you got to figure out how much is going to splash on them when they apply it. So assuming they put on, as per instructions, the rubber gloves that go up to here, and assuming they wear a respirator. Health Canada said, wait a minute. Have you ever met a farmer? They're not going to do that. I grew up on a farm. I have some sympathy for this view. Health Canada said, look, it's not fair to assume farmers are going to follow those kinds of strict guidelines. And Monsanto, on the other hand, said, wait a minute, it's not fair to blame us for the sloppy work of the farmers. Right? So what you immediately see was that the science could be skewed by not shoddy science, right? Not bad science, not malevolent science, but different value assumptions going in. Now, this is not to engender cynicism about science or risk assessment. It's just to show why people legitimately worry about influence and the effects of bias on people's judgment. Science isn't value-free, and so we need an open discussion of the values that underpin the science we do and the science we fund. A last couple of words. Just touching very briefly on corporate funding, it's not going away, but I think we need to carefully differentiate three very different kinds of risk. There are things like conflict of interest, a fairly subtle thing. There's actual collusion, happens sometimes, that's less subtle. And then there's the shifting of research agendas, right? And I know this is a worry in the health sciences as much as anywhere else. And we need to remember that these different risks require different methods of management. They're not all the same. The last thing I want to say is about universities' ethics and risk. Universities need to get better at this stuff, right? I work mostly in business ethics, and a lot of corporations will say things like, well, we make carpeting. We sell carpeting. We're not experts at anything else. We're not experts at that conflict of interest stuff. Universities are in a quite different position. Universities have expertise, not just in science and technology and in medicine, but also in ethics and policy and psychology and risk assessment. So universities need to, many of them are working hard at it, unequally, unevenly, and with varying levels of success, but we need to use the expertise we've got within these walls to be more proactive at finding the right way to structure interaction with industry so we can both do good research and instill confidence in the public. Thanks.
Thank you. Perfect. Dana?
Well, thank you very much. Thank you for the invitation to address this meeting. I want to make a series of points which I don't think amount to anything like a systematic anything, but I think they're all points that I'd be curious to have you take up in discussion. The first thing I'd like to do is evoke the work of a former colleague of mine in the Faculty of Law at Université de Montréal, André Lajoie, who upon her retirement took on a writing project which had nothing to do with law. It had to do with what, in her view, was encroachments onto academic freedom that were occurring in Canada before our very noses, and that made it the case that it was harder and harder for individual researchers to carry out curiosity-driven research, to carry out the kind of research that Jay was talking about earlier today when she was talking about going down the rabbit holes and seeing what was there. Now, the thing about André's work is that it had absolutely nothing to do with corporations. It had to do with the way in which, year after year, the funding sources that we have from the government are restricting our ability to carry out curiosity-driven research. I have a career which has led me to interact both with SHRC and with CIHR, and even at perhaps even more at the SHRC level and at the CIHR level, I can tell you that every year when the programs come out, the amount of the envelope that is devoted to people just being able to follow their instincts and their intuitions to where they will go relative to government telling us, these are the questions that you will study, right? That proportion has been shifting to the detriment of curiosity-driven research year after year steadily, and that's what André's book documents. And so now, I don't want to deny that some of the questions that government asks us to research are not good questions. They are. But the fact is that if we're worried about academic freedom, we have to worry about threats to academic freedom coming from all sides, and not to belittle the degree to which we are essentially at risk, yes, of corporate takeover, but also of being used by government as ways to deal with sometimes quite short-term policy issues where our I think talents could be used looking further down the road. So I think that academic freedom is a terribly important topic that universities have to take perhaps more seriously than they have, but we have to do this in a sort of all-encompassing manner that includes both government and corporate threats to academic freedom. The second thing I'd like to talk about is my experience with ethics in universities. Now, it's perhaps a paradox that we do REBs now. We have institutional structures that people have to go through in order to get ethics certificates for the research to get carried through. I'm struck by the degree to which our thinking about the way in which we structure REBs has remained relatively stagnant over the course of, well, the last X years since we've really started institutionalizing these things. And I'd like to make an analogy with something that I was quite involved in for a number of years as the first director of the Quebec Public Health Ethics Committee. The Public Health Ethics Committee has at its mandate to review ethically the public health interventions that were proposed both by public health teams and by the ministry itself, by the Directeur Général de la Santé Publique, and to give advice on the ethics of these interventions. Now, what I was struck by is that the understanding that people had of ethics pretty much on all sides was that ethics consists of a kind of checklist, right? You think about what you want to do your research on in a completely ethics-free way, and then before the protocol goes in, somebody reminds you, we have to get the ethics certificate. So let's do that. And so there's 11 things that we have to show. In the case of health research, informed consent. Do we have informed consent covered? Yes, good. So ethics is very superficial. It's something that we think about at the tail end. It's something that we think of in a very superficial way. It's something that we think of as, you know, if we just get these 9 principles checked off, we've gotten ethics covered. And I think that is a very superficial conception of ethics. I don't want to deny the importance of making sure that people's informed consent is respected. I don't want to deny the importance of confidentiality. I don't want to deny the importance of all of these things. But what I want to say is that the kind of work that we do, especially in the, well, throughout the university, is ethical through and through. We are carrying out research which is funded by the public, and that's something we should never forget, no matter how much money we get from corporations. I have been receiving shirk money since I was 21 years old, and I'm now 24. I've been receiving money from the taxpayer of Canada for close to 30 years in the form of grants as a student, research grants, et cetera, by extension grants to my postdocs. My education was funded by the government. I paid almost no money to attend McGill University, this fine institution in the 80s, and people are still paying essentially no money to attend this fine institution. And it's that's only possible because of the very, very important, we would like it to be more, but very important public investment that is made in these institutions. So that when corporations come a-calling, one of the things that we have to remember is that the public has its interest and it has a stake in the research which is which has a dollar amount associated with it. It is a massive public investment. So I think that the way that we should think about ethics review has to change to reflect the fact that this is an ethical enterprise that we're engaged in the university through and through, and that to some degree, yes, the choice of topics should be driven by corporate, sort of curiosity, Freudian slip, by curiosity, but to the degree to which we should feel ourselves to be subject to external constraints, some of those external constraints, they're not external constraints, internal constraints, should be ethics. Are the things that we are researching ones that conduce in some very, very general way to the public good, where the public good includes things like being the transmitters and the vehicles for the perpetuation of a culture and a civilization, not just sort of short-term interests. So I don't have any specific proposals about how to rethink REB in order to incorporate this, but I think that we still have a vision of REB that embodies or that reflects a conception of ethics that is altogether too superficial, too kind of checklist-like, and too much at the tail end. You know, everything that we do can be ethics-free until we get to that point where we have to fill out the ethics checklist, and by that point all the important decisions have been made. I think that that's something that has to change. I'm a great believer, this is going to be my last point, how am I doing for time? Good. I'm a great believer in a Madisonian, James Madison, the framer of the American Constitution, said something which, you know, one of the 10 or 12 sentences that I learned as an undergraduate that still resonates when I think about the way to in which to do political philosophy or moral philosophy. He said something which might sound pessimistic, which might sound sort of like a downer. He said that institutions should economize on virtue. What he meant by that is to say that when we design democratic institutions and we want to avoid the worst excesses that, say, the concentration of power could give rise to, the thing not to do is just to assume that we can get better people, more virtuous people, into those offices than the ones that came before. What was wrong with the ones that came before is they were corrupt in their souls, and if we just get better people into those offices, everything will be fine. Madison said, and I think it's a very great insight for institutional building, institutional design, whatever the institution, that we have to economize on virtue, and the way to economize on virtue is to have structures, institutions in place that will channel sort of the kinds of incentives that we might have that might lead us to bad ends in certain circumstances to better ends. And so I think that when we start thinking about the question that my last remark suggested, what would be a better way of doing ethics in a university than the REB structure that we presently have, we have to be guided by the Madisonian dictum. And I'll give you a very homely example, again drawn from my own experience. When I became director of an ethics center at the University of Montreal, the phone was ringing almost without incessantly from various institutions asking for ethical advice about this, that, or the other thing. And one day I got a call from the maximum security penitentiary here in Quebec. It's psychiatric ward. The psychiatric ward of the maximum security penitentiary situated about 50 kilometers from Montreal. So, you know, a place where, a tough place. And the gentleman, the warden, explained to me that they were having a terrible problem because they had a conflict between the security, the guards, I guess, of the institution and the medical personnel that was on staff. What exactly was the conflict? Well, it's not far enough from dinner that I can tell you without ruining your supper completely. They had a few cases of inmates that would engage in quite unbelievable self-mutilation of the kind that, until I encountered them, I didn't know that you could actually engage in with your own bare hands. And the conflict was this. The guards basically wanted to let them stew for a little bit whilst they committed these acts of self mutilation upon themselves, just to make them understand that they were not the bosses here. This was clearly an attempt by the inmates at controlling the situation and getting attention devoted to them. Very strange way of doing so, I will admit, but this is the psychiatric ward of a maximum penitentiary, maximum security penitentiary, whereas the medical personnel had it as their duty to intervene as quickly as possible in order to put these people out of medical danger. And so a conflict arose between these two very different kinds of ends that these two different professional orders had. And could I resolve the situation? So I came up with a very revolutionary proposal, which was that these people talk to one another on a regular basis about the kinds of cases that they encountered in order to make clear what each other's ends were, what each other's finalities were in their jobs, and how these could give rise to conflicts. And this actually generated a permanent structure, a structure which I think survives to this day. I finally had to get a graduate student of mine to take it over for me because I just didn't have the time to go over there every month. And it has apparently appeased the situation. Now, this is not rocket science. Getting people to talk is not rocket science. But I still think that it gives us in embryo a recipe for the kind of structure that that we need. We have to be open, we have to be accountable. People's interests, incentives, those of corporations, those of the university, those of researchers, have to be on the table in a deliberative structure that can appropriately, first of all, get all of those interests on the table so that we know what we're dealing with and find ways of reconciling them. Because I agree completely with Chris. In an ideal world, we would be funded by angels who would have infinite amounts of money and no independent interests on how that money gets used. We are not being funded by angels. The interests and the pressures are there from all sides, and I think that the only way in which to make it the case that this is tolerable and compatible with continued academic freedom for institutions is for us to do much more creative thinking in ways in which to organize structures, to incorporate ethics more deeply into the way in which we think about the research that we do than the kinds of structures that we presently have. That was a terrible sentence with which to end, but I think I will end with that. Thank you.
So thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm going to come at it from a little bit of a different take, and I'm the founding director of an Institute for the Study of International Development. So we work on trying to make people's lives better in ways that they appreciate. And a couple of years ago when we were created, we were thinking, well, where can our expertise be most useful? What kinds of things can we do that's different? Remembering that our mandate is to build bridges between university research, the public sector, the private sector, and the not-for-profit sector. So we decided, let's work on corporate social responsibility. I'll just give you a quick anecdote to give you a sense of what this meant for us. I get a phone call. CEDA, Canadian International Development Agency, had just announced that they were going to fund development projects that were partnered between NGOs, big nonprofit organizations like Care Canada, World University Service of Canada, and World Vision, and gold mining companies. So I get a phone call from a student, a McGill student, so she should know better, right? She said, how can those NGOs sell out? And I'm thinking, well, what makes you think that they're selling out? And these are organizations that have helped tens of thousands of people. They've been operating for decades. Why do you think they did it? And we talked it through, and I explained to her that maybe you are just jumping the gun. Hung up because we were talking on the phone, and then I realized, what does she think of us? We're 4 years old, and we're doing the same thing, but we don't have the reputation of having worked for decades in Africa or Latin America, although individuals like myself have that reputation. And at the same time, a lot of the people that were part of our natural constituency, myself included, were skeptical. And why were we skeptical? Well, for example, when I cut my teeth as a PhD student way back in the mid-80s, the topic of my dissertation was the military coup in Chile, where social responsibility meant that businesses would openly and actively try to undermine the elected government, knocking on the barrack doors trying to get help. So things had changed a lot, but there was still a lot of ignorance. A lot of people didn't really understand it. And there's something else that separates out what we're trying to do from other university kinds of activities. As social sciences, we don't have the same kind of scientific method as medicine or other hard sciences would. We are rigorous, believe me. We try and do the right thing. But there's also a normative subjective element that always makes it more important for us to maintain our good reputations. In fact, we often move in to help when science is ambiguous, there is no clear answer, or it's insufficient because you need to set priorities, you need to deal with trade-offs, you need to deal with how much risk can a society take. Asbestos is a good example of all of these different things. So the stuff that we work on, the areas that are most of most interest to us, are the areas where science and methodology and rigor are the least useful, and we ultimately have to fall back on our good name. So here we are getting in bed with mining companies, often some of the companies with the worst reputations around. And so how do we deal with that, or how did we try and deal with it? The fact that we still exist suggests that we haven't done too bad. And the way we deal with it is several-fold. First of all, there are the pragmatic reasons. Number one, this is the trend. And so when the student called me, it was because the Canadian International Development Agency had announced about 6 months after we committed to doing CSR work, announced that this new partnership between public and private sector organizations funded out of the taxpayers' funds. So we were trying to be ahead of the curve, and it turned out we were right, even though the pushback was a little bit greater than we had thought. The other is that given the austerity that everybody's dealing with nowadays after the Great Recession of 2008, funding sources are simply harder to come by. So you have a trend in the area that we're working in. You have a general sense of austerity. Other people have talked about it. And so what are we going to do? Who are we to try and buck the trend? But there's a third pragmatic reason as well, and that is something that academics in particular often forget. Successful businesses are successful because they're productive. There's a revenue stream, there's a long-term time perspective, and believe me, anybody who's done development work knows that the worst thing is that every year you got to go back and try and get more funding. Maybe if you're lucky it's 2 years, maybe it's 3 years, but you can't do much in 2 or 3 years. Factories are built to last for 20, 25 years. Mines are built to last for 30 or 40 years. They're multi-generational. They succeed because they're a revenue stream, and that's why they're also a target, because they appear to be wealthier than they really are. So for pragmatic reasons, if you can connect production and revenue and a long-term perspective, you can get a lot of stuff done. And, of course, we got into it not only because it was an important area, because it was an area we felt we had expertise to offer. On the one hand, a lot of people, myself included, have a long history in working with conflict resolution. Well, most of the problems in CSR are all about conflict resolution. We do a lot of work also in areas dealing with sustainable development in terms of creating employment, livelihoods, and dealing with all of the other things that you can deal with if you have a steady income without being dependent upon the state. So we, for pragmatic reasons that are all too easily ignored, we felt this was the right decision. But there's also something that goes beyond pragmatics, and that really, again, is twofold. And this is what I actually told a student as well. If we don't do it, who's going to do it? I mean, well, at least we're well-intended. We want to do the right thing, and most of the people that we're working with at McGill have been doing it in their own way for 10, 15, sometimes even longer. So we do have a track record, even if it's not as prestigious as Care Canada. And so if we don't help corporations get it right, what's going to happen? And the odds are it's going to be worse than it would otherwise. But there's something else, too, and it's something that Daniel also said in a slightly different way. We exist as professors. Our livelihood, however precarious it might be, is dependent upon taxpayers' money, particularly in Quebec. And so what better way to return something to society than to make our university research relevant? So this is why we did it, for pragmatic and other kinds of reasons. We're fairly successful, but we're successful not because of the reasons that drove us to do it, not because I could explain to the student why this is a good thing to do, but how we managed it. And the way we managed it, and it's actually very similar to how the NGOs managed it, is very straightforward. And it's, first of all, it's the criteria. We don't work with anybody. And so some companies are taboo. We will go nowhere near them. But our criteria allow us to work with other companies under certain circumstances. The first and the most important is that it allows us to achieve our mission, which is to help contribute in practical, real ways to making the quality of people's lives better in terms that they would appreciate. So if we don't violate that cardinal rule, then we're on solid ground. Second of all, we choose our partners because they have shared goals. Now, we don't care why they have those goals. The point is that they have those goals. It could be self-interest. It could be protecting themselves. Doesn't matter. We're not going to get into their motivations. We're more concerned with their actions. And so if they're willing to help us on our own terms, then we're more than happy to consider working with them. And believe me, we put them through a pretty rigorous process. We just don't work with anybody. They think that they're trying to test us, but we're really asking them if we want to work with them on our own terms. The third is academic integrity. And what that basically means is that we're not going to sell ourselves out for our own ounce of gold, even if it's worth $1,400 or $1,200 an ounce today. The point is that the research we're going to do, it's policy-oriented, it's practically oriented, but it's going to follow the same criteria that has defined McGill as a research institute par excellence. We're not going to give away on that. And if companies or anybody wants to give us money doesn't understand that, then we don't want the money. And it's not only companies, it's private donors too. They often have their own hidden and sometimes not so hidden agendas. So the first is the criteria for deciding who we're going to work with. The second is the nature of the relationship. And this gets back to academic integrity. We have to preserve our autonomy. Whatever the funder wants in terms of outcomes is independent of what our outcomes are going to be. Those are going to be determined by our own tried and proven methods of going about our research. And if they don't want that, we don't want them. So the second element, in addition to criteria, is autonomy. And third of all, it's transparency. If it's all done behind the scenes, if it's all done in back rooms, if the research that we publish is proprietary and can't be made public, it's not worth it. On the one hand, it feeds people's worst suspicions. If you're not sharing information, what are you hiding, even if you're not hiding anything else? But on the other hand, it limits our ability to achieve what we're really all about, which is making university research contribute to a better world in the area of international development. And so that student, I think I convinced her, but the real truth is that I was happy she called me, because obviously she hadn't thought we sold out so much that I was such a traitor I wasn't worth talking to. But that's the challenge we have to deal with, and it's one that's not easy, but we think it's worth it, and we obviously, for all sorts of reasons, practical and less and more altruistic, we're going to continue with that. So thank you.
Thank you. So since they all kept it high, I'm happy to take some questions from the floor.
Thank you. Thanks. I became interested in this a long time ago, and reading corporate documents has, I originally was an agnostic on the question of corporate social responsibility, and 35 years of reading corporate documents has made me an atheist on the subject. But what I'd like to ask you, Dr. Weinstock, specifically about the chemical industry, which I've been concerned about the export of hazardous industries and the double standards since the Bhopal disaster, since 10 years before the Bhopal disaster in 1984. And the only things I've seen written about corporate social responsibility talk about allowing flexible time for the workers. One company gave the workers ice cream on Fridays. Other companies were giving money to local charities and probably spending 10 times as much telling us about it. I'd like to know, is there any other examples, more real examples of corporate social responsibility by the chemical industry, which in the age of globalization has outsourced its production to companies whose names they won't even disclose, their suppliers in Asia, in China and India. What corporate social responsibility have you seen by any of the chemical companies?
You mentioned, you named me, but I think I may defer to Chris and...
Oh, I'm sorry if I asked the wrong person. Please, help yourselves.
On CSR, on corporate social responsibility.
Sure, and I don't know much about the chemical industry. But I think, you know, I think there's a couple of problems. One problem is the notion of CSR, right, corporate social responsibility, often gets inappropriately used as an umbrella term for everything corporations ought to be doing, and that's a mistake, right? So basic questions of integrity, basic, you know, paying your taxes, doing, you know, basically not lying to people, that's not necessarily corporate social responsibility. It's usually, and I think properly, corporate social responsibility is reserved for that big kind of soft question about what you should be doing in addition to, you know, treating your employees fairly and not lying to your customers. And so, I think corporations vary enormously that way. I think you're right that sometimes, or maybe you didn't say it explicitly, sometimes I worry that the explicitly social stuff, we're going to build a soccer stadium, is used as a kind of, you know, balancing of the scales, and I think that's incredibly dangerous. Like, you can't let a company do bad things with one hand and then do some cheaper good things with the other hand and somehow hope that that balances out. And I think that's a real worry. But, you know, I think corporations are as varied as, I mean, one of the things I, you know, try and impress upon many audiences, this audience is kind of unusual, right? When I ask my back when I used to teach in a philosophy department, I teach in a business school now, I used to ask my philosophy students, so who here plans to work in business when they get out of school? And no one would put up their hands. And then I would ask them what they think they're going to do for a living, right? Because they're all going to go work in businesses. That's what people do for a living unless you've got weird jobs like ours. And so most people you know are in business, and most people you know are basically kind of honest and decent human beings who, you know, most people, you know, want to try and make the world a better place. Something weird goes on in certain companies, right, and in certain other kinds of institutions where it doesn't add up, right? So you get a whole bunch of people going into the pharmaceutical industry because they want to make the world a better place, and then something goes wrong, right, somewhere along the way, and you get a bunch of bad behavior by that industry. It's kind of a long-winded way of saying I'm cynical as well about certain kinds of corporate social responsibility. I just think we need to be careful not to use too broad a brush.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things...
If I can say something.
I don't think any of us knows about the chemical industry.
Yeah, so unfortunately, we are mostly philosophers and a political scientist not working on the chemical industry. But I can point you to a book by David Kinley. I think it's called Civilizing Globalization, in which he does talk about the basic findings in the social sciences about corporate social responsibility. So, you know, corporations from about the 1990s onward especially started adopting voluntary codes of conduct as a way to, first of all, prevent state regulation of their sectors, yeah, of whatever they were doing, right? So it's sort of what one of the presenters, yeah, said, that industries try to control themselves as opposed to, yeah, well, state regulation. And so one of the basic findings about human rights in the global economy is that a lot of these corporate codes aren't very effective in the absence of state regulatory frameworks. So
in many developing countries where states suffer from incapacity or weak institutionalized rules, corporate social responsibility frameworks don't do all that much to helping to prevent mm-hmm. certain kinds of human rights violations. Yeah. But in other cases where there is a better state institutional structures, more state capacity, then social corporate social responsibility codes have a better chance of thriving. So in fact, it turns out that these two things have to kind of go together. And so I think probably, Phil can talk more about the relationship perhaps.
I don't know the chemical industry in detail, and Catherine's right, and this is what what our model is. It's not only corporations. We use CSR as a label, but it's really a lot more than that, including governance and community relations. And oftentimes the problem is at the governance level, but it's also at the community level. We have this romantic view of the peacefulness of communities, but they can be pretty nasty places, especially when money is involved and you're poor. But the other thing I was just going to say very quickly is that there's at least two big differences since BOFOL. One is that the world has changed, and if you want to get any funding from the International World Bank system, you've got to at least implement some codes. Now, that doesn't mean that they're perfect, and believe me, they're far from perfect, but they're a start. And so it's a slow, very slow process, and we're trying to nudge it along. The other thing that's changed, and I think this is increasingly important, is reputation. You know, some work has shown that maybe 30, 40 years ago, I can't remember how long ago, 20% of a corporation's value was based, a publicly traded corporation, was based on assets. Now it's, and 20% was on image, and 80% was on assets. Now it's pretty much the reverse. So the cost of a BOFOL doesn't mean there won't be any more, but they're more and more less likely simply because the costs have gone up. And it's gone up because of standards and norms and corporate social responsibility and more, and new changes in governance structures, and a lot of things that are happening within civil society. Movements that try and hold corporations accountable are often just as important as stockholders are in a lot of places, including Africa and Latin America.
Catherine?
The proposition before us is that it is okay to go to bed with big industry, pharma, chemical, if you're careful. That's what you're telling us. I would suggest that all the evidence that we have says that you might make it for one night without too much intimacy, but go on for a year, and there is a high probability that you will get up to some hanky-panky. And if you want to do this and convince us, the outsiders, that you are being driven purely by inquisitiveness with integrity and honesty, we're going to suspect you because we think history says you're in a very optimistic position. I wonder, as a suggestion, if you would not consider some sort of an internal ethical review of what's going on. Asking, you suggested that we need something better than the formula of the ethics reviewer. I'm suggesting something more like a committee set up with members of your organization and industry and 7 or 8 Catherine Ruffs from the public as members of that committee to just check you and say, yes, you're okay, you're still being straight.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the sort of thing that I was definitely sort of gesturing towards. Of course, the devil is always in the details, the questions about composition, questions about mandate, questions about independence, questions about the purview, I think become crucial. So, we've pointed at a space within which we have to start thinking about the way in which to do ethical oversight of these relationships more seriously, but we haven't yet said exactly what is going on in that space. And it's kind of it's a paradox for me that, we're all extremely busy, and we all have, part of the reason why we're busy is because we have research grants that require that we produce deliverables on this or that research topic. And so we don't have the time, and when I say we, I point the finger at myself in a way. We don't have the time to do the kind of serious research upon the ways in which these details would need to get would need to get worked out, that we do to have to do research on the way in which, you know, democratic systems halfway around the world should be organized, you know, if we're working about political science. So I think that, you know, if there was one call that could come out of this meeting, I say this carefully, realizing that sometimes when you make a call.
Yeah, really. Yeah.
You know, one of the things that could come out of this meeting is that a space be created and time be devoted to thinking about the way in which that could work. And one of the things that I really, and I go back to the very first point that I made, because as a someone who used to apply for most of his funding from SHRC rather than CIHR, I worry about, as much about the sort of governmental partner as I do about the about the private partner. Yeah. So. Yeah.
I didn't talk about it, but we have internal vetting structures. So the people that run the Institute along with me, we talk about these things. But our most important vetting service is our advisory board, which includes well-known people from the private and nonprofit and international sectors. And the fact that they're willing to associate with us means that their reputation is now at stake, too. But you're probably right. We're going to stay away from chemical companies. We don't have anybody from chemical companies on our board, and maybe that's a good thing.
I also wanted to say, because I used to be a chair of a research ethics board at McGill, that there is usually a community member, a member of the community who's, you know, not an academic on each of the research boards. And I do remember as chair that there was a couple of research, you know, projects that were deemed to have to be revised in light of the community members' you know, sort of thoughts about the inappropriateness of some of the strategies used for research. So, you know, so they definitely have a role to play in. I'm sorry?
When 50% of the members of the community are being more convinced.
Okay. Yeah, and. Right. Okay, so, but again, I think something coming out of this panel is exactly about questions about institutional design to especially, I think, help achieve exactly what I think most of the panelists are saying is universities have a certain specific mission, which is, you know, about the pursuit of knowledge and the public good. And so how do we reach that mission and make sure that the way that it's funded or research is carried out does not actually take us away from being able to complete that mission? I think that's very important. Okay, other questions with her? Yes.
Yeah. Thanks. Dr. Phil, I thought I'd approach you that way because it's more popular. You mentioned the mining industry more than once. Obviously, it's big on your agenda relative to other industries. Thanks to China, for the last 20 years, I was just at the World Mining Congress just as a delegate, and they said, look, mining is not everything, but without mining, you got nothing. That's the way the Chinese described it to us. So, anyways, Canada has not played a good role in this whole setup, and I know you're working for a Canadian institution. We had a bill in the Parliament of Canada called Bill C-300. You remember it well. Just about got through second reading on a private member's bill. Anyways, there's no way the Conservatives are going to let that go through because the money talks and, you know, BS walks. So at the end of the day, you obviously have to do something that can convince the mining companies that you can keep, well, confidential information isn't going to be much for your transparency. So how are, and the mining companies, I'm sure there's some good parts of mining that they can talk about that you might discover when you go there. And I was hoping you'd always, it would be always transparent, especially in South America, where the boom is on. Is there anything that you can keep the confidentiality and yet, you know, get the goodness out of the mining company so we can have a little bit of balance? Mm-hmm. Is that your approach, or I mean, how are you going to approach these mining companies when they aren't talking?
Well, I mean, there's confidential information that's proprietary, but there's also, you know, anonymous interviews that we use all the time. There are ways to protect it. It's always trying to find a balance. The kind of stuff we're working on is not getting into the technical detailed aspects of mining, but it's rather mining relations with communities and governments, where that kind of information is somewhat easier to access and share.
Was there anything to replace Bill C-300? We need bare diamonds, or you could have an easier job. That's from the federal government.
Well, no, we're not. for the reasons that Daniel just said, we don't want to advise the government. They wouldn't listen to us anyway. No, we're not working at that level. We're working more vis-a-vis other countries rather than Canada. They're easier to easier nut to crack.
All right. You were talking earlier about having a member of the community on ethical review boards. What exactly constitutes a member of the community for these purposes?
So I don't have all the rules on me, but do you have somebody?
Yeah, I'm a member of the Research Ethics Board at Ryerson. Basically what it means is someone who's not affiliated with the university.
Could it be someone who's had some sort of former affiliation with the university?
I'm not sure about that. I'm not sure about that. One of the challenges is that the Tri-Council policy statement that we're working under, the piece of the federal regulations, are guidance. They're not, so they are suggestive of how things ought to be run, how the universities ought to constitute the research ethics boards. Not much of it is extremely prescriptive and written in black and white. I mean, it's an actual written document, but a lot of it is you should have this, you should have that, and you must. There are relatively few musts, and they don't go into that much detail. But I will say that finding community members is a challenge. Especially people who have both an interest, who have the time to donate, because research ethics boards are volunteer boards, and who have enough interest to have some insight and to want to give their time, but not so much insight that they're in a conflicted situation.
I think that again, and this goes back to the point that I was making in response to the gentleman before you. The devil's in the details. It depends what you want to achieve. I think that there's two kinds of members of the community that you want. There's the kind of member of the community who's going to let you know what it looks like from the point of view of the receiving end of the kinds of policies, the kinds of types of knowledge that you'll be producing, or these are sorts of things that resonate with us. But I think that the idea of I think Phil was mentioning, leveraging people's reputations. So not just members of the community, sort of anonymous individuals that you wouldn't know, but, sort of fairly eminent personalities that don't have a connection with the university or with business and whose reputations are on the line. I am perhaps the last Canadian in Canada who's actually kind of a fan, not of the way in which we do it, but of the idea of the Senate. Which is an institution which isn't elected officials, which tends to be extremely unvaried. The Parliament of Canada is made up of 70% people who have law degrees. It's a very non-pluralistic space. And the idea of the Senate, where you get people who will give sober second reading to bills and who represent a whole variety of different walks of life, including people who have built up reputations, which reputations, as we can see now with Pamela Wallin amongst other people, you would want them to take their reputations more seriously than they do, but their reputations are at stake. I won't let certain things stand because, amongst other things, it will make the reputation that I've tried to build up over 50 years sullied. Remember what I was talking about earlier, the Madisonian point, economizing on virtue. That idea, the concern with reputation is a powerful, powerful force that we can leverage in certain kinds of circumstances for good purposes, and the kind of thing that I'm thinking about here.
In light of that, what would the panel have to say?
In light of that, what the panel would have to say with respect to disclosure. From the perspective of much of science that's out there that the public gets to read is in medical journals, and medical journals are the interface between scientists and the community that eventually gives credibility to that. So there is a major, now we accept a standard disclosure of commercial interests and financing for the studies. What would you have to comment about that?
I think disclosure is something we do because, or it's something we should do, because people have a right to that information, not because it's actually effective to give them that information, right? So there's pretty good evidence that disclosure doesn't actually get the job done. It doesn't. There's some experimental evidence actually that disclosure makes things worse, because once I've disclosed my conflict, then I can just be as biased as I want to be, mm-hmm. right? So there's and that's not a conclusive. But so on the one hand, we should be cautious about disclosure as a panacea. But on the other hand, remember that there are other kinds of reasons. It's not just about the outcomes we want to generate. It's if I'm, as your patient, if I have a right to that information, then you should provide it to me, even if I'm not going to know what to do with it. Similarly, if disclosure in the pages of a journal is not going to necessarily tell me how much I should discount those findings, I still think the public has a right to that information.
That point that Professor Weinstock was mentioning, which is the reputation of the individual.
In theory, it does. In practice, it's not clear that it actually changes behavior that much, but probably still a good thing to do anyway. So keep doing it.
I mean, reputation is a relational thing. You know, reputation, you don't have a reputation in the absolute. And so, you know, if everybody who's conducting research is getting money from corporations without too much care given to the kind of corporation that they're getting money from, then, you know, I mean, this could be mapped out in game theoretical terms. You know, nobody is... Sorry?
It's just a new equilibrium
point that nobody's really getting any benefit from. So, you know, I think, again, I agree with everything that Chris said, and I would say that disclosure for me is just part of the view of ethics that I was sort of gently chiding at the beginning, or not so gently chiding at the beginning of my talk, which is the sort of checklist conception of ethics. As long as we, can check this box, we're okay. It's not clear to me that we are, because again, it depends on what everybody else in the environment is doing.
So I just wanted to follow up on a couple of these ideas by saying that the experience in, I'm going to go to a different area, which is not an ethics area, but if you look at performance in hospitals in terms of following guidelines, the whole issue of quality and safety and accreditation, I'm sorry to report that good intentions, disclosure, and reputation have no power to protect in the sense of ensuring that doctors, nurses, and others do the right thing. Mm-hmm. We know from experience that even people who are quite knowledgeable about what they should do and who are very well-intentioned will unfortunately succumb to human nature and cut corners, do things that are maybe not the right thing but justify it to themselves and so on. And I'm not excluding myself from this behavior. So in the end, the only way to really be sure that we're going to do the right thing is, in addition to all the constructs that have been put forward, there has to be some review, or there has to be some holding to account on a regular basis in which one has to demonstrate that you've gone beyond paying lip service to virtue, but actually have done the right things. And that's not something we do generally in research ethics. Right. We set up IRBs. We set up pious policies. All the people who sit on the IRB work hard, and I think that's part of the issue with getting a community member. It's not a trivial, if you're going to do a good job, you have to review all this material often in abstruse specialist language only understood by the high priest. And so it's a big job. But we don't actually go back and check to really make sure. Now, it's interesting that the Tri-Council is very interested in checking on how we handle our financial transactions, and there are several people in this university who are spending a lot of time to make sure that all the taxi receipts are properly accounted for. And, of course, as a taxpayer, I'm glad that we're accounting for our taxi receipts. But actually, I think it would be nice if we were also able to be sure that our research was independent of either government, NGO, or corporate influence, and was really being driven by a pursuit of truth, whatever that is. So I think I've been thinking a lot based on a conversation I had with Catherine Ruff before, but also what you said, Daniel, which is, what can we do to do better? And it seems to me that one of the things we have to think about doing is having some way to actually check to see if what we think we are trying to accomplish is actually being accomplished. And as far as I know, and maybe one of the other panelists can correct me, that's not really done very much outside some very, very specific circumstances. It's certainly not the standard of practice here in Canadian universities, as far as I know.
I think that's right.
Yeah, I think, again, with the research ethics boards,
you know, researchers are supposed to give information about themselves to their research subjects so that if there is some kind of complaint, you know, the participants in the research can then contact the Research Ethics Board and, you know, start a process of investigation. But of course, it's actually very rare for that to happen. And you can imagine that, you know, people who go do research in developing countries where people are not even signing consent forms, you know, so there is this difficulty of checking. Even if it's happening here, there's always, you know, are people going to really call you and so on. So I do agree that there's not that much checking going. It's sort of, you know, based on good faith, but then, of course, also just on the fact that disasters
can happen. What happens is that the checklist becomes an end instead of a tool. I've done the checklist, I'm okay. And so all the assumptions behind it and the goals behind it, they fall to the wayside. And sadly, it's when you need those other things most that they're violated because they've checked off the right boxes. And so part of the problem is to have a more thorough, ongoing process rather than only a checkbox.
Well, I should, in defense of the REV at McGill, you know, I think Linda McNeil would say is when we do presentations to graduate students or faculty, we constantly say to people, you know, or at least I did when I was in that capacity, we constantly say to people, it's not about a checklist, you know, it's not enough just to have informed consent. You need to think about, you know, the contribution of your research and how it, you know, how vulnerable your subjects are and what sorts of ethical challenges arise, you know, and so don't think about it as a checklist. But of course, I think, practically, this is how many people view it, and so the question is, okay, let's come up with some ideas on how to change that view, right? And I think also the problem is a lot of things that have come up are actually not about this aspect of sort of research design anymore. They're also about, you know, how do you, you know, whether or not you accept funding, for example, has to do with whether you, there are just some conflicts of interest that you cannot get into. Those situations you just cannot get into because no matter, you know, what human nature being what it is, you know, you're just incentivizing people or providing the wrong incentive structure, right? So that's kind of a question that falls right outside of the REB. And I don't know what institutional sort of frameworks are actually existing for determining those sorts of things.
There are also longer-term problems. Is it working? Yeah. Longer-term problems. One of the panel members, I mentioned research agenda. I can give you an example from the respiratory field, which is where I work. In the 1990s, the pharmaceutical industry decided that inflammation was important in a disease called COPD because they had blockbuster drugs they were using in asthma, but the market was saturated. So all of a sudden, inflammation had to become important in COPD, a big growing industry. And they managed to switch the research agenda to this day, inflammation is considered important in COPD. I don't think it has any importance whatsoever. It's, you know, a personal point of view and probably a minority point of view. But they managed to totally switch that research agenda. And billions have been spent and tens of billions have been made with the drugs to treat this inflammation, which I don't think exists. And the checklist is never going to get close to that. I don't even know of the group of getting together of trying to look at this because it's such a long-term trend and it's so subtle but strong.
Yeah, I mean, in a way, it's never going to be perfect. That's one thing. Nothing you know made by humans is ever going to be perfect. But you know, I think that in any relationship between corporations and researchers, there are some big potential. I mean, it's exactly what Chris was saying. Conflict of interest is a space. It's not an accusation. And so when you're in a conflict of interest, in a way, that's a good thing if you can identify the conflict of interest because you can take proactive measures. And, you know, imagining some kind of a body that we would create at McGill, which would have as its function to do the sorts of things that Dean Adelman was talking about, you know, one of the things that could be asked is what, not in checklist form, you know, but what concretely have you done? What structures have you put in place to avoid the predictable kinds of reorientations of research that it's just in the nature of the beast that you would be pushed towards? What have you done? It won't be perfect, but you know it'll be better than obviously what we have now. And this is just sort of thinking off the back of you know thinking off the cuff. I think that you know we could probably come up with something better, revisable, you know, perfectible if we actually gave ourselves the time to step back from all of the you know hundreds of thousands of research agendas that we have and just think about the structures within which this research is housed and the function that we wanted the structure to have in achieving this end, which, amongst other things, you know, excellent research, but also research that, as an institution, when we look at what we've done, when we look at the way in which we've used all this money and all this brain power and all of these resources, we could say, you know, we have made the world a slightly better place than it was, you know, but for this research. It's a little bit mawkish, but...
Just an example that may, I don't think it's really, it. Most of the bulk of the problem is not on the edges. And let me give you an example of that. There's a lot of pharmaceutical research going on. Some parts of informed consent, and for some companies, said the patients waive their right to sue in exchange for guaranteed medical coverage if they get anything wrong with them, no matter which wing of the study they're on, because they're blinded studies. I've seen the data from, for example, Merck and Vioxx and several other pharmaceutical companies. I've never seen any patient informed in any study that they had a side effect from anything that they could, never mind get compensation for, be aware of. There was one case that was noteworthy because a guy got hypertension on Vioxx, and he asked for his copay because he was British. So it was only like £10 a month. And there were about 30 letters and emails back and forth between England and Merck about whether they should pay him for his copay. I don't know what the resolution of that was. But that wasn't because his private doctor said, oh, you got this from Vioxx causes hypertension. So there's a huge space out there where things are not cloudy. They're obvious. And that space can be addressed relatively straightforward, in a relatively straightforward way.
That's probably right.
Okay, so maybe any concluding thoughts from our panelists? No? All right. Well, thank you all very much for the discussion, and let's give our panelists thanks for theirs.